From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The longtime personal lawyer to Donald Trump is going to prison for a series of crimes. The government has also implicated the president himself in some of those crimes. Europe's three M's, Merkel, May, and Macron, all facing a variety of difficulties. The U.S. Senate deals a setback to President Trump concerning Saudi Arabia, and Time Magazine's Person of the Year is the journalist. Well, let's start with the sentencing of a man named Michael Cohen. For 12 years, he was the personal attorney to Donald Trump. But now Cohen is off to jail. And the issue here is, what might this mean for President Trump himself? Tom, good to see you again. We'll start with you. What was Cohen convicted of exactly?
Well, he was convicted, among other things, and he pleaded guilty to this, of making illegal campaign contributions, specifically facilitating the transfer of so-called hush money to keep unsavory stories about President Trump's alleged affair or affairs secret before the 2016 campaign. And that's considered a campaign violation, which is a crime, and the amount of money was at least $130,000. So I think it's the tip of the iceberg. Cohen has been cooperating. He was looking at years and years and years of prison time, and he was sentenced to three. And the government has said that he's been very helpful, which cannot be helpful to President Trump.
Now, Tracy, the president said in an interview this week that this was not illegal. These were not campaign contributions. It was essentially a business transaction that had nothing to do with the campaign, even though these payments were made just on the eve of the election itself.
Yeah, of course, President Trump's story shifts pretty regularly. At one point, he knew nothing about the payments, and then he knew about the payments, but they were not illegal. So it's a little hard to take what he says at face value. I think it's important to note that Cohen was not convicted. He pleaded guilty. So there's no question about, from his perspective, about what he did and why he did it. President Trump is desperately trying to distance himself from Michael Cohen, which again also doesn't really hold water given the many years, as you note, that he was working for President Trump. I think this whole issue goes to the heart of President Trump's problem, and Michael Cohen actually is talking about this now after the sentencing, that Trump does not understand the system that he is representing. And a lot of the practices that one engages in as a cutthroat real estate businessman are just not allowed when you are the president of the United States. And that's a lesson he never quite internalized. And I think we're going to see a lot more of these kinds of problems coming up for the president.
No, I did say it. I need to correct myself. You're correct that he pled guilty to these crimes. He was not actually convicted of them. I think that's important to mention that. Now, looking forward, in about 3 weeks, the Democrats are going to take over the House of Representatives. As you know, for our listeners, that's the lower chamber of our Congress here, and there is talk that these Democrats are going to investigate the president for all kinds of things, and they really have to make a decision whether or not to proceed with impeachment against the president. Now, is this what we're talking about here, these campaign finance violations? Is that something that, in your judgment, rises to that level?
Possibly, depending on who you listen to, who you talk to. There are members of Congress who say, yes, it's an impeachable offense. Others who say it is not. It's going to be tricky for the Democrats. Nancy Pelosi, the California congresswoman who most likely will be Speaker of the House when the Democrats take over, has cautioned about going too forcefully towards impeachment because it does sometimes have a backlash, and that the American public doesn't really want to see that happen. And perhaps the better way is to slowly build the case against Donald Trump and then in the future impeach him or wait for the next election and vote him out. So the Democrats are sort of wrestling with just how to deal with all of that.
Tom?
Well, I agree with that, but I think the Democrats want to slow this down to the point of waiting for Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller to issue his report. No one knows when he'll do that, probably sooner rather than later, but not till after the first of the year, after the holidays. And I think that whatever Mr. Mueller concludes, he will conclude things that are not helpful to the president. And so I think it makes no sense for the Democrats to rush out there as the first order of business. They can do their investigations, and there will be plenty of investigations about ethics of the president and his daughter and his son-in-law and various members of the cabinet. There will be investigations on how much money has been spent by security agencies to protect the multi-zillionaire children of President Trump, and whether that's appropriate. All of that will happen, but I think impeachment, if it is in fact mounted, is probably not going to happen for a while. And I think at the moment, many Democrats will say, why should we do that even if we think he's guilty of impeachable crimes? Because impeachment is just a vote by the House. If a president is impeached, as Bill Clinton was impeached, there's a trial in the Senate, and three-quarters of the senators have to vote to convict. And so the Senate did not convict Bill Clinton, and there's no way a Republican-led Senate is going to convict Donald Trump in an impeachment scenario.
Well, moving ahead, the U.S. Senate dealt the president a pretty symbolic setback in voting to cut off U.S. military aid to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, of course, have been using a lot of that weaponry to prosecute its war in Yemen. Tracy, you've been writing about this. Tell us what this is all about.
Well, symbolic, but also very important. It's the first time that the Republican-led Senate has defied President Trump so clearly, because President Trump has been saying, you know, do not interfere with Saudi Arabia, do not do anything that would, however, impede the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia and the use of those weapons in the Yemen war, which is a catastrophic conflict that has led to what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet currently, with millions of people facing starvation and tens of thousands of civilians killed by Saudi airstrikes, which the U.S. has been helping with. So the Senate finally decided it could no longer tolerate this. It was exacerbated by the murder on October 2nd of a U.S.-based Saudi journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, who in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, who was murdered by a hit squad that the presumably, according to what we understand from the intelligence agencies of the United States, was sent by members of the royal court. And so the implication is that the crown prince himself, Mohammed bin Salman, a good close ally of Trump and his family, was responsible for this murder. And so that's what the Senate did in two measures. One, to order the cutting off military aid to Saudi Arabia in its war in Yemen, and unanimously voted to condemn and blame that murder on Mohammed bin Salman. So nothing necessarily will happen from this, because the White House can veto it, the House still has to hear it. But it is important that several Republicans crossed over and joined with the Democrats in making these condemnations. And that's the first time that I know that that's happened.
Now, there's something that occurred to me, and I'll ask you about this, Tom. You know, President Trump has been accused of many in what we call sort of the establishment of kind of stepping back from America's traditional role on the world stage and abandoning certain allies and denigrating longtime institutions that we've had since the end of World War II, essentially. And yet here he is standing by one of those allies, Saudi Arabia, and yet it's lawmakers who are perhaps taking a step back from that. Is that a reasonable point to make? I mean, he's accused of stepping back, and yet with Saudi Arabia, he wants to stand by them.
Well, yes, that's exactly right. And the U.S. Senate is saying we disagree with this warm embrace of the Saudi kingdom. It's important on several levels. One is senators believe that the Trump White House was not truthful about what the U.S. government knew about Khashoggi's murder. I mean, the president and others are saying, well, you know, the CIA isn't really clear about this. There's matter for debate, but the CIA director came to the Senate for classified closed-door hearings and basically convinced all 100 members of the Senate that the Crown Prince was up to his eyebrows.
It was a very convincing briefing.
Yeah, yes. And you had people that are who are known apologists for President Trump, like Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who came out and was just almost vicious in his denunciation of the role of the government in all of this. And so that's part of it. But also, I think, as in everything in Washington, Paul, there's a political component. And the political component is Republican senators who are up for re-election 2 years from now saw what happened in the House of Representatives, which is going to be now run by Democrats in 3 weeks, as you noted. And they're worried about being too close to Trump going forward. So I think this is, on several levels, this is trouble for the president. For the first time, Republican senators have broken with him on what President Trump feels like is a very important policy consideration to stick with Saudi Arabia. And I think he will lose this. But Tracy is right. This is basically a symbolic gesture. The House of Representatives is not going to go along. But it's an important development nevertheless.
Okay, let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today.
Welcome back. The three most important leaders in Europe, some people call them the three M's, Germany's Angela Merkel, Britain's Theresa May, France's Emmanuel Macron, are all facing some very tough and different political problems. The backdrop for all of this, I think, is a European Union that some say is fraying, perhaps falling apart. Let's go through each of these briefly, and we'll start with Britain. You know, Britain has been trying to leave the European Union through this so-called Brexit plan. The British voters voted for this 2.5 years ago, and they're still working out the details. The prime minister barely survived a vote of no confidence, and now she's run into further trouble in the EU itself, where she met with leaders. How is all this playing out? Do you want to take a stab at this one, Tom?
Well, I defer to Tracy on the guts of this, but basically, Theresa May, the sense within some quarters of the U.S. State Department is that Prime Minister May has survived for the moment, but only for the moment, and she's probably on a downward slope. And it's also pretty well known that President Trump wouldn't be all that unhappy about that, which seems to be not very wise, because anytime you have what at Newsweek, where I used to work, was called scuffling in the wheelhouse, and there's a lot of scuffling in the wheelhouse in the British government, scuffling in the wheelhouse internally with one of our longest and most enduring allies is not good for anybody, not good for the U.S., not good for Great Britain, not good for NATO, not good for the EU. It's not good, and I think she's in trouble, and there's some talk, I guess I don't think it'll happen, that maybe there will be calls for a revote because the move for Brexit was narrowly approved, and a lot of people in Britain seem to be reconsidering their view. So all that turmoil is not good for the Western alliance. And the one person who loves this kind of turmoil is Vladimir Putin, of course. This plays right to his strategy of across the board of trying to diminish and dilute democracies
and these Western institutions and so forth. Well, Tracy, let's kind of go across the channel here to France, as you know, these big protests in the past couple of weeks, the so-called Yellow Jackets, people who are unhappy about gasoline taxes. France, I believe, is one of the highest taxed countries in Europe. Macron wanted to raise gasoline taxes even further. There's that. There was a smallish terror attack this week. I think three people were killed. The gunman was captured also. So just a variety of problems for Mr. Macron as well. Bring our listeners up to speed on what's going on there.
Well, Macron finally had to back down on the gasoline tax because the protests were so severe throughout the country. And so he's had to back down on that. I think The taxes were partly connected to the whole climate change issue of trying to reduce reliance on fossil fuels, and that just didn't work. The terrorism, again, as you say, it was a small attack, but it just adds to the sort of uncertainty and unease that France is experiencing now. And as Tom said, I mean, the people who most savor this whole disruption in Europe, Vladimir Putin, but also Donald Trump, you know, as he has been so friendly to Saudi Arabia, to Egypt, to even Putin, the U.S. traditional allies of France, Germany, and Britain have been sort of neglected and even dismissed by Trump. And so I'm not saying that has contributed to their problems, but it just
hasn't helped.
It hasn't helped. And it's part of this context of, at least from the White House, less respect for the European Union.
The other side of that coin, quickly, Paul, is Tracy is right on all of that, but it's also true that President Trump has cozied up to other European leaders who are more authoritarian. I mean,
exactly.
The leadership in Hungary, for instance, and Poland to a lesser extent.
Yes.
And so this is seen as disruptive to the major Western European powers as well. As I said, I mean, I think that President Trump would love to see Prime Minister May go down the chutes and be replaced, let's say, by Boris Johnson, who was her foreign secretary but resigned in protest over Brexit and is salivating at the prospect of maybe trying to become prime minister himself. All that turmoil in Europe now is almost Trumpian because the president thrives on turmoil and chaos and being the ringleader in the center ring all the time. And he's not unhappy about some of this.
Well, be careful about what you wish for. He could get maybe a Jeremy Corbyn leader,
right,
of the Labor Party, which would give Trump even more problems. We haven't talked about Angela Merkel yet. As you know, she's on the way out. She stepped down under pressure as leader of her party. Well, I think we're talking perhaps about arguably the world's most powerful woman, certainly the most powerful economy in Europe itself. What is happening in Germany? I mean, the economy is still doing quite well there, but she's under fire from issues like migration and this kind of thing. What bring us up to speed on Germany?
Yeah, I think the migration issue is what really did her in. Germany allowed a lot of immigrants to come from Syria and other parts of war-torn world, and that has backfired on her. She's a fascinating character, and in a way I'm sad to see her go. It's really the end of an era. You know, she grew up in East Germany under communism and rose to become, I agree, the most powerful woman in the world. But I just think issues caught up with her that she could no longer confront the right-winging in Germany of all places, which is particularly potentially dangerous, has been on the rise. This anti-immigrant sentiment, nationalism, even...
Well, it's a continent-wide trend.
It is a continent-wide trend, but seeing it in Germany is, I think, especially alarming to a lot of people. That, you know, in a country that had been so stable and is the largest economy. And so I think we'll just have to wait and see what happens with the next elections. The new leader of her party, less tested, and as I say, some of the more right-wing parties on the rise in places like Bavaria. So it's something to watch.
Here's a quick question for you. I'm going to read a quick blurb from the Wall Street Journal, and it talks about something we were referring to. European economies are generally in pretty good shape. Here's the question. If the German center takes a beating when unemployment is under 4%, what happens if things turn south and it goes back to 6 or 8%? If there are riots in the streets of Paris as wages rise, what will happen when they start to fall? If Britain is this divided with a strong economy, what happens when Brexit or no Brexit, the next downturn comes? And here in America, of course, what happens if the Trump boom turns to bust? I mean, people are unhappy when times are pretty good.
Yeah, people don't seem to realize the situation they're in sometimes. Yeah. You know, the economy was in the United States was doing great at the end of Obama, and yet somehow President Trump and or candidate Trump at the time and others have convinced many Americans, not all, that they're doing really poorly. You know, the carnage across the nation, as he said in his inauguration speech. So I don't understand that psychology where people, Americans, Europeans, can be convinced they're not doing well when in fact they are. There's something that I just frankly don't understand about that disconnect.
It's perhaps the politics of fear that some politicians
can be stoked so easily.
Well, let's move on here. Finally, we were talking about Mr. Khashoggi just a couple of minutes ago, the journalist who was murdered. He is a big part of Time magazine's decision to name journalists their person of the year. They call it the Guardians, and they focus on a group of, again, journalists who've been targeted for that work, for their work. That includes Mr. Khashoggi. It includes five journalists here in the United States who were killed at a Maryland newspaper a couple of months ago. Also, two, I believe, Reuters journalists who are still imprisoned for their reporting in Myanmar. To me, I'm very happy that that's a very good group of people to select, Tracy.
Yes, I agree. I'll only say two things. One thing is, you know, I was in Mexico for many years where journalists are killed this past year, almost one a month. And so I think it's long overdue, in a sense, to recognize journalists and how important they are to any attempt at democracy and at finding truth. I think this is also an important message to us in the United States because we are seeing erosion of trust in journalism and in journalists who are trying to report the truth. And I think there's just so much disrespect right now, fueled in part by the president and other politicians, that it just so undermines any kind of trust in the system and dedication to improving the system. And I think that's a shame. And I think this Time cover also dramatizes that.
And Tom, this recognition kind of is set against a bigger and disturbing trend of people who can post things on social media that are clearly false, and they can doctor videos and pictures and sound. So technology, which is supposed to help journalists, can also be turned against them, and that's part of the problem, too.
It's a double-edged sword, to put it mildly, Paul. I mean, I can't tell you, and I'm sure both of you have the same experience, I can't tell you the number of times I'll look at something on a website and I will say, where is the editor that allowed this paragraph, which is blatantly false, to go into that report? And the answer usually is there was no editor, because as you say, there are websites where people, anonymous people, just make up stuff and send it off, and all of a sudden it's reached 100,000 viewers worldwide, and it's made up of whole cloth. It's a real problem, and it's not getting better. It's getting worse. And so the whole attempt to undermine the media is really corrosive on many levels, but it's also dangerous to democracy.
And it's fair to mention there was certainly distrust of the media long before President Trump came to office. But I think it's fair to say that just through his own rhetoric, he's made it worse. Let's be honest about that. What can be done to turn that around? I mean, do we just keep doing our jobs the best we can every day, point out when officials lie, and can we use the word lie? I wonder how do we do it?
Yeah, I think we should use the word lie a lot more often than we have, but we are beginning to do it a lot more. I think education, you know, I don't know how you reverse what has happened in the last few years, but I think it's education. People are not educated enough to know how to distinguish between whole cloth lies and reality, and that's a very deep and long-term problem, and I don't really know how that's solved quickly. Okay. Well, it won't be solved quickly.
It would help if the president, with all due respect to the president, would stop referring to the media as the enemy of the American people.
Correct.
That's baloney, I'm sorry to say. And so the president, among others, if they could turn down the rhetoric, that would be a useful first step.
Okay. All three of us, I think, certainly agree on that. And we're going to have to end it right there, thanks to two of Washington's best journalist, Tom DeFrank, he's a contributor to National Journal, and Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thanks for joining us.